Aloha. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. The outbreak of the coronavirus that began in Wuhan, China, continues to spread, even with a major effort to contain it. We look at the potential global and local impact on the economy. Composting. We continue to look at our opala and how to encourage more use and reuse. And what's this about plastic in our soil? And we're just coming off the Oscars. Lots of buzz around the movie industry, but this morning, we'll be taking a look at the upcoming GLAAD Awards. A local film, Ladies in Waiting, has been nominated. It is Monday, February 10th. The conversation starts right after the latest local and national headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The top two Democrats to emerge from the Iowa caucuses in a dead heat are requesting a partial recanvass of the results. Both former Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Senator Bernie Sanders are riding the momentum of strong showings in that race, with each looking to pull ahead for a decisive victory in New Hampshire tomorrow. NPR's Ron Elving looks at what's at stake for everybody else.
Elizabeth Warren really needs to do well tomorrow night because of the financial question and because she needs to break out before we move into some of these other primaries further away from her home state of Massachusetts. We might also see a real pressure on Amy Klobuchar if she doesn't do well, although she's been rising in the polls. It might be a little late. And There are also people asking questions about Joe Biden's future. He needs to do at least respectably in New Hampshire.
NPR's Ron Elving. The intelligence agency that guards against spies trying to penetrate the U.S. warns the threats are getting worse. NPR's Greg Myrie reports Russia, China, and others are using methods that are more sophisticated and widespread than ever before.
Russia is again trying to interfere with the U.S. election, says Bill Evanina, the director of the National Counterintelligence and Security Center. But Evanina, whose job is to prevent spying on the U.S., says the threats are coming from many different sources. He says the massive hack into the Equifax credit agency is part of a larger Chinese effort to vacuum up U.S. data in all sectors, finance, technology, and healthcare. In laying out a new national strategy to combat spying, Evanina says it's no longer just a U.S. government problem. Private companies, universities, and individuals are often being targeted and need to take greater precautions, he says. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. has charged four members of China's military with the 2017 cyber attack on Equifax and theft of personal data belonging to tens of millions of people in the United States. The defendants are unlikely to be extradited from China. Amazon is seeking to have President Trump deposed in its legal challenge of a lucrative defense contract that got awarded to Microsoft. That's according to court documents unsealed today in a case that Amazon is pursuing against the Pentagon, accusing it of bias against CEO Jeff Bezos. Here's NPR's Alina Selyukh.
Amazon wants President Trump and Defense Secretary Mark Esper to testify in court about the massive military tech contract that the company lost to Microsoft. Amazon is challenging the Pentagon's award of the $10 billion cloud computing contract. It's called Jedi. It had been mired by controversy for months. At first, rivals alleged Amazon itself had cozy ties with military officials, but then the president got publicly involved, asking Esper to review the bidding process. Amazon later accused Trump of interfering out of a, quote, personal agenda against Bezos because he owns the Washington Post. The White House and the Pentagon are likely to fight Amazon's deposition requests. Alina Selyukh, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Lots of hand-wringing as a number of new cases of the coronavirus continues to climb around the world. We take a look at what this means for the economy. Chris McNally is an adjunct senior fellow at the East-West Center and is on the faculty of Chaminade University. He sat down with us last week to talk about the short and long-term view.
The biggest difference is that the Chinese economy has really changed. It's a different economy. It's much larger. It's about 15 times larger than it was back in 2003, and it's much more service-oriented. So that means a lot of things like entertainment, retail, tourism, transport, all of those are much bigger parts of the economy than they were back then. And those parts are the parts that are really being hit hard. Again, we are not really sure how much the various quarantines and, you know, quite drastic measures that the Chinese government has taken have actually helped in reducing the transmissions, because the data is very backward-looking. And in this kind of a situation, you know, a lot of the data, a lot of people haven't been tested. They've been running out of testing kits. People haven't been admitted to hospitals. There is likely to be a lot of people who are only mildly sick. They have a cough, you know, sore throat, runny nose, very light fever, who might just quarantine themselves or even just, you know, not go to the hospital. So we're really not quite clear of the extent, but we are now getting people going back to work. So it's likely that transmissions probably could increase, but they're taking all kinds of measures. Everybody's wearing face masks, which helps stop transmission from a person who's sick to others. They're also disinfecting. They also, you know, people are staying away from each other. They're keeping their distance. So all of those things are probably going to be quite helpful. But it's a really kind of tough dilemma that China is in. On the one hand, you'd like to shut the whole place down for longer to be really sure that you don't get extra transmissions. But then that also has real disadvantages, because you need the economy to get up and running again. There's quite a few reports of certainly shortages of surgical masks, of various protective gear, gowns, etc.
But aren't some of those, you know, the masks and the gowns, aren't they made in China?
Yes, a lot of them are made in China. They're actually importing quite a lot from also Korea and Japan, from, you know, other countries around China. But yes, a lot of that stuff is actually made in China. And those factories, for the most part, have actually already ramped up production in the last week. So they kind of shut down over the Chinese New Year because everybody goes home and has a vacation. So that was actually not part of the measures to stop the transmission of the virus, but rather just the Chinese New Year. But then, you know, as it became obvious that this was a real problem, they actually asked all those factories to start work early. So a lot of those actually have been ramping up production. And the same thing also with testing kits and other things for various types of medicines, pharmaceuticals. They've been actually really getting back to work already last week. But the general economy, so everything from car manufacturing plants to transportation services, all of that is gradually starting to ramp up again. A lot of factories, such as the ones around Wuhan, are going to be closed for much longer. There's some very big car manufacturers around Wuhan, also parts manufacturers, which is hurting, you know, some other countries around the region as well, because China's deeply integrated economically with South Korea, Japan, and also the United States. You know, so Hyundai is, for example, one factory. They had to not only close down their factories in China, but also close down their factories in South Korea because they're not getting sufficient parts to continue their production cycles.
So a lot of the impact on the economy is also tied to how long does this last, if we're talking about a short thing, a prolonged thing, couple months versus 6 months?
So the most important number for the economy right now is actually the level, you know, the amount of new infections that are being reported every day, as well as obviously the amount of deaths that are occurring. As I said, it's really difficult to estimate exactly where this disease stands in terms of its transmission within the Chinese society, because a lot of it is backward-looking. We've had a lot of people who are probably silent carriers or, as I said, with very mild symptoms, and then they didn't have enough testing kits, especially in Wuhan and in Hubei. Actually, Wuhan is getting better from what I'm hearing, but there's quite a few very large cities around Wuhan that, you know, Huanggang and other places that very few people have ever heard about, but these cities have like 4 or 5 million inhabitants, and they're really, really struggling. They have a lack of protective gear, but also a lack of these kits. Their hospitals are absolutely overflowing. So it's going to take some time to work through this. But the Chinese, at least the people Zhong Nanshan. This is the doctor who was very instrumental during the SARS epidemic, and he's back basically as one of the persons in charge of what is happening right now, and he seems to be optimistic that we will see a leveling off of new cases.
There's been some drastic action taken where they've stopped flying into some cities, you know, here in Honolulu. What's your sense? I mean, so we're not getting the tourists maybe that we used to.
Chinese tourism market actually reached its peak in middle 2018, more or less exactly when President Trump's trade war with China started. And since then, we had actually quite a precipitous decline. So the decline from kind of the peak in June of 2018 to June of 2019 was over 30%. So we had a real decline in tourists, also because it became more difficult to get visas. But at the same time, there was also an impression by the Chinese that, you know, they weren't so welcome in the United States. And there were many other opportunities, other countries they could go to that are much easier to go to, especially Europe. So I was in Europe during early 2019, basically in the spring, and the major tourist sites are absolutely overrun by Chinese tourists. So Europe has been really doing very well with Chinese tourists.
So USA,
Hawaii,
not so much.
Not so much. I mean, the big cities, Los Angeles and New York, still have quite an important share of Chinese tourists. And as you mentioned, they're really big spenders. So they spend about $325 to $350 per day here. That's one of the very highest. The average is around, I think, $190, $180. But in the Hawaiian market, they're basically, they've come down to just a bit more than 1% of the market. So now we're going to lose that. That's going to go to zero. That's going to be a bit of a hit, but it's not as bad as it could have been.
I think the concern, though, like what we saw with SARS, is the Japanese tourists, because we rely so heavily on that market. And when they get nervous,
yes,
they stay home.
Yeah, and you know, the Japanese are a very big part of our tourism market. They're about 15%. They also spend somewhat more than, you know, folks coming over from the mainland. If the virus spreads in Japan, then yeah, the Hawaii tourism market could be in really deep trouble.
What do you see in other parts of Asia? Just because we're so interconnected now.
For Hawaii, the main market really is Japan, to a lesser extent Korea. Both of these countries seem to be in a relatively similar situation. They are getting some local transmission, but it's still very, very limited. So we will just have to wait and see. Most of the other markets like Southeast Asia, the Philippines, Thailand, etc., are very, very minor for the Hawaiian tourism market. Although, you know, there's very, very close connections, especially with the Philippines, in terms of, you know, people to people. So it's going to be difficult to see, but certainly in Japan and also in Korea, there are increasing calls to basically do the same that the United States has done and basically disallow any Chinese or non-Japanese coming from China who have been to China within the last 14 days from entering the country. Both South Korea and Japan have not yet taken these measures, but you know, there's increasing calls because you're getting more and more cases.
Where else do you think we're going to start seeing the impacts of this?
It's difficult to tell. I mean, there have been actually some indications that, not with the vaccine, but that there are some effective treatment options that the Chinese are now basically putting into an experimental stage. So it's very difficult to basically judge how this virus is going to continue to spread, how it continues to develop. It could mutate as well. It could become nastier or it could become much milder. But it really depends. I mean, if you look at the stock market, it seems to be taking this whole issue in stride for the time being, because the economic impact is somewhat limited, at least so far. But if this continues and if the Chinese don't really get a handle on it, you know, the question is, what happens if, let's say, they are able to reduce transmissions to a very low rate, but it continues?
Right. And we've got a situation where American companies that are doing business in China are also starting to pull back, you know, whether it's the Kentucky Fried Chickens, the Pizza Huts, the folks that have chains,
yes,
in that area.
I mean, it's certainly going to be a hit for quite a few companies. I mean, you look at Starbucks, they had to basically shut down most of their stores in China. McDonald's had to do the same thing in the province of Hubei. China has been a booming retail market. When I started, basically, the Chinese economy has really changed in the last 15 years. It's become a lot more consumption-oriented. In 2003, 2002, when the SARS outbreak started, China still very much was kind of becoming the factory of the world. It was a very manufacturing-oriented form of development, whereas now most of the development that's taking place in China is actually consumption-oriented. So China has become one of the biggest markets for movie theaters. All of these have now been shut down for all kinds of entertainment. Disneyland in Shanghai and also in Hong Kong, both of them have shut down. So this is going to be a hit to the bottom line of quite a few American companies. But it's difficult to judge at this point, because so far most of these retailers or entertainment companies or amusement parks have only shut down for about 2 weeks. If they shut down for a month, it'll be a relatively minor hit. But if this goes on, let's say, into late March, into April, then the effects can be, quite intense.
Now, I know Japan is getting a little nervous with their Olympics coming up. I don't know if there are any other big events that China was to host or maybe conferences that were scheduled here in Hawaii.
I am not aware of any conferences. I mean, there's a major conference in my field in international studies. The International Studies Association is coming up, and my European friends have been asking me whether there will be any influence. But I said, there's no cases so far here, and everything seems kind of normal and quiet. But in the case of China, the next big event is going to be the Winter Olympics in Beijing in 2022. So that's still quite a ways off.
Okay.
But yes, Tokyo is very concerned about the Summer Olympics. And again, China is the second largest economy. So even if, let's say, the impacts do not spread to other neighboring countries or to the United States, the fact that China has basically shut down for an extra week, that already has a substantial influence. The real question is, how much longer can this go? Various reports have said that, especially for Chinese small and medium-sized manufacturers, so these mostly are private companies run by private entrepreneurs, they probably could go on for another 2 or 3 weeks. But after that, you could start to see mass bankruptcies, and that then could affect the financial system.
Right. There are folks that are worried that this could be the thing that sets us into a recession.
It could be. It could be a trigger. I mean, we've been kind of, it seems, over the past 18 months hoovering along, and people have always been predicting a recession is kind of just around the corner. And about a half a year ago, most people were saying, 2020 is going to bring a recession for sure. Now, most would say no, because the trade war with China, one of the major factors influencing these predictions, has kind of calmed down. We have a ceasefire and some form of agreement between Washington and Beijing that are keeping, these kind of tit-for-tat tariffs on the wrap. So that's a very positive sign. The U.S. economy continues to do well. The American consumers is going quite strong. But you never know if this does continue. And if worse comes to worse, there's really more person-to-person transmission in the United States, then that could also influence the U.S. consumption. Or, as I mentioned, Japan, which is much closer and has many more cases than the United States, that could also have quite a considerable influence on the whole world economy. But we already see it in things like commodity prices, oil prices, what's happening in China immediately has ripple effects throughout the whole globe. It's interesting, in my opinion, how the financial markets have been reacting to this. Their first kind of knee-jerk reaction was a big, big drop. We had one of the biggest drops in the Dow Jones Industrial. Basically, things have been recovering. And so it's kind of the psychology that you see. And it is something that markets, it's very difficult to deal for them because it's not something that you can predict with economics. And even people who are, immunologists or virologists or, people who study these communicable diseases will have, it's very difficult to predict how this whole thing is going to develop, whether, it can be contained within the next few weeks, whether it is contained most of it, but then you continue to have transmissions and it could kind of reemerge. It might even reemerge next year again. So all of these are really big, big unknowns.
That was political economy professor Chris McNally talking about the impact of the coronavirus on the global and local economy and the difference with the SARS outbreak that we saw in 2003. Up tomorrow, we continue our conversation on our preparedness to deal with this outbreak. We'll be talking with the Hawaii Healthcare Association CEO, Hilton Rathel. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Eddie would go. The famous slogan probably conjures up certain images and feelings. Maybe it's the famous portrait of Eddie Aikau, stoic and contemplating on board the Hokulea. Or the story of Eddie swimming for rescuers after the voyaging canoe was stranded at sea. Or maybe it's Eddie in that iconic surfing stance, riding down a mountain of a wave, but making it look oh so effortless. Or maybe it's the big wave surf contest named in his honor, where the world watches as men ride mountains of water during the most hallowed contest in all of surfing. Every December to February, surf enthusiasts wonder if the bay will call the day. But did you know the first Eddie Big Wave Invitational did not happen at Waimea? Where was it first held? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. If you know the answer, the first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the realtors and staff of Locations, proudly supporting HPR's commitment to sharing stories of Hawaii's people and places. Locations, welcome home.
HPR is bringing you a number of stories about trash and recycling in this new year. And this morning, we circle back to the issue of composting. Reporter Ku'uwehi Hiraishi joins us live to talk about the efforts on the Garden Isle. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. We were able to look at this backyard effort pretty much to divert a lot of the waste that goes into the landfill on Kauai, and this has been a long-going program for them. So Kauai County has been offering these free composting backyard bins for about 17 years, and so wow. they've seen getting in there early has really allowed a lot of residents that I have met while on my visit to be exposed to the idea that they have this backyard solution. So food waste or green waste when you're doing your yard, compostable waste, really, newspapers, paper, cardboard, whatever you are generating in your household can be put into these composting bins and turned into soil or mulch for you to use in your garden. So it doesn't even get to the point of having to be handled by the county, meaning no pickups, no collection, no having to deal with contracts, contracting someone to do it. This is something that everyone can do at the household level. And according to Allison Fraley, the Solid Waste Management Program Coordinator for Kauai County, it is one of their most cost-effective diversion programs, aside from trying to get people to recycle and trying to get people to use less waste or generate less waste. This has been their top program.
It's about a ton a year per household, so it's a significant amount of waste that is being diverted. I've seen other communities that do sales or are subsidized, but it's, you know, considering how much is diverted through this program, it's just a no-brainer to purchase them outright and get them out to the public so they can use them.
And free really goes a long way anywhere when households are thinking about, okay, what can I do to help with the waste problem without having to, you know, strain my bank account?
That's impressive, though. A ton a year,
exactly, per household. So we're talking about food waste and as I mentioned earlier, green waste on Kauai, and I think on most of our islands and counties here in Hawaii, green waste is diverted. We understand that, okay, this can go somewhere else. And so a lot, I think the diversion rate on Kauai is about 64%. So 64% of the green waste that's diverted by landscaping services or households, that all is not taken to the landfills, but instead turned into mulch or something that can be used as a product for gardening.
Interesting. So it's amazing that Kauai's been at the forefront. Yeah, I guess because maybe they're small and they have the, you know, the flexibility to move on a dime.
Exactly. What I think the total cost of the unit's going to be from $50 to $60 per unit. But when you think about the amount of waste that is diverted, according to Keola Key, the head of the county's recycling program, they make that money on that one bin back in a year in terms of the amount of waste that's being diverted. So very cost effective. But when they kind of take a bigger look at everything that is going into the landfill, so anything that's compostable, all that paper, all that green waste or anything that gets in there that can be composted at the household level, it's trying to figure out how to do that perhaps at a local regional level, right? So a bigger, large composting facility. And I met Nikki Kuniokavols, a Kapahi resident at the transfer station in Kapa'a. And she had this idea of having the same sort of, you know, all the dumps, having a place for composting to drop off your compost, so to drop off your food waste, drop off your green waste in those areas and have that composted along where you would take your trash.
I would like us to see, like, how we have here, how we have these sort of refuse stations and drop-off points. I'd like to see something like that for compost. That would be awesome, you know, because there are certain things that we don't want to compost at home. There are rodent problems. You don't always want to compost your meat waste, you know. You don't want to compost your dairy and your cheeses because that brings out the larger rodents and the larger pests. So to have smaller sites that are spread out, for me, would be a huge, huge impact.
So thinking about what to do next, I guess, for Kauai, because they are at that point where they're updating their solid waste management plan, and perhaps a regional composting is something that the residents might want, that they might want to consider to get more of that compostable waste out of the landfill and turned into mulch, essentially, and gardens and whatnot. Jesse Brown-Clay, the project coordinator for Zero Waste Kauai, has done his program, and what Zero Waste Kauai has done on Kauai has been to teach the younger kids in the schools what composting is about, so that they can see when they take their lunch, right, and they have all this food waste, that they can turn that into something that will help them grow more food. But starting with that younger generation, it's educating them about the impact as well of what happens to our organic material when it does go into the landfill, that there are consequences, environmental consequences, to having organic waste in the landfill.
The issue is that organics in the landfill, so green waste, food waste, stuff that is like biological, when that's in the landfill, it's breaking down and causing leaching, like all the water is kind of running out and grabbing up all the other toxic stuff in the landfill, and it's hitting the ground and going into the water table. And it's also off-gassing and releasing methane at the same time. So having organics in the landfill is kind of not a good thing. The awesome thing is composting is a local solution. And so kind of what we'd have to do is we would collect our food waste and send it to an industrial composting facility. We can also have small-scale regional composting facilities and community gardens. You know, this can be done in our backyard. And so for me, it's just kind of like it's a local solution for like a global issue.
And in speaking to Fraley, the solid waste management coordinator for Kauai County, there were some permitting issues in terms of the Department of Health, who regulates whether or not an industrial sized composting facility would be available on Kauai, or could attain the room, the permits for them. She said that there needed to be some changes to allow for that. At that level. So Kauai County has been working with the State Department of Health to figure out how they can move forward with an industrial size composting facility. I do know on the Big Island, I think the target date was June last I checked. June 2020 was supposed to be the opening for a large-scale composting facility there. So I think we're going to see a lot more of those possible solutions, those alternatives to figuring out how to take that compostable waste out of our landfills and divert them early. For Kauai, this is only about 10% of the total waste stream. But statewide, I looked up the numbers, about 26% of the food in Hawaii statewide goes uneaten. So possible food waste that could be used in compost.
Well, I think I'm with the Akoi resident, with Nikki, that, I don't want the bugs, I don't want the maggots, and I don't want the rats.
There is, yes. So all things we need to talk about when we figure out what to do next.
All right. Thanks so much, Kuvehi. That was HPR's Kuvehi Hiraishi talking about how Kauai is leading the state on efforts to encourage backyard composting.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting Hokusai's Mount Fuji, featuring the ukiyo-e print series displayed one at a time throughout the year. HonoluluMuseum.org.
We continue to talk composting. Honolulu Civil Beat is featuring a story online today about plastics in our soil. Reporter Claire Caulfield joins us this morning for our reality check. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. I was really surprised when I read your story today. And I mean, you hear about plastics in the water, but in the soil, it really made me think about that.
Yeah, microplastics in our water is something that's really talked about. It's been a lot of research, and the scientific community is really aware about it. But this new trend of finding microplastics in soil, it's an emerging science. A group of farmers came to me with this story saying that they've seen so much plastic in compost, in soil, and mulch. And at first I was confused, same reason. Oh, I didn't know that was a problem. Once I started looking into it, it really surprised me as well.
And you reached out to what, landscapers, right, to find out what they're seeing?
Yeah, so one landscaper that I spoke with, he's also helps farmers and gardeners plant their fields, and he drops a lot of his green waste off at Hawaiian Earth Recycling, which is the largest provider and maker of compost on Oahu. And so he was seeing how they stopped checking trucks like his when he was dropping off green waste for plastics. He said they used to check it a couple of years ago, but now they're not doing it anymore, and he thinks that's one of the reasons why there's more, an increased amount of plastic.
So they just take it, they don't reject any loads?
According to these guys, they've said they've seen that. Hawaiian Earth Recycling didn't want to talk to me for this story, but a bigger issue, a bigger reason why there's so much plastic in compost and mulch is people throwing plastic in their green waste bins on Oahu. That's where most of the material that gets composted at Hawaiian Earth comes from, is people's green waste from residential homes, and people throwing plastic in there has been an increasing problem.
So we're talking like plastic forks and spoons kind of stuff, or lids?
Anything. Actually, the biggest thing would be plastic bags. Actually, on the side of the recycling bin, it says, you know, plastic bags should be avoided as much as possible, but it doesn't ban them. And I think a lot of people put their grass clippings from their lawnmower, they're putting leaves in plastic bags, and instead of dumping the plastic bag into the green waste bin, they just throw the bag in there. And then when all that material gets shredded, obviously those plastic bags get shredded as well, and they make it into the compost because they maybe aren't sorting out the plastic. But yeah, it can be utensils, it can be plastic bottles, people walking down the street not realizing the green bin isn't a trash bin, it isn't a recycling bin, it's a green waste bin, and maybe throwing their bottled water in there.
Gosh, you're making me think twice now, because I have several bags of green waste sitting in front of my garage that I was gonna, you know, it won't all fit in my one green bin, and so I'm just like holding it. But interesting. Okay, I've got to do better on the plastic bags.
Yeah, that's what some experts I spoke with, they say, yeah, it's concerning that perhaps Hawaiian Earth Recycling isn't sorting as much plastic out, but it really comes back to Oahu residents. What really inspired me to do this story was whenever I write about microplastics on our beaches or plastic pollution in the water, I get a lot of emails from people saying, oh, well, all this plastic is coming from other countries, there's nothing we can do about it here. Then when I learned about plastic in Hawaii soil, it's like, well, Hawaii residents, you know, we can't really point the finger to any other countries when it's showing up in our soil. So, yeah, it's something we definitely all need to take a look at in our own lives.
But you said it was farmers that first flagged this to you?
Yes, because they're the ones buying this compost, soil, mulch, and using it. And they're obviously, you know, some of these organic farmers, they are really health-based. They really care about the plants. They treat their plants like family. And they get really upset thinking about growing their plants in soil that has a lot of plastic in it. And obviously picking the plastic pieces out, they can pick the big pieces of plastic out, but those microplastic pieces, they're not able to sift those out. And they're also paying hundreds of dollars for this soil. So, yeah, they're really upset, and that's what started this story.
That's interesting. I wonder what the Ag Department has to say about that, you know, and the Health Department.
Yeah, I did speak to the Health Department. They don't they permit composters. They don't check it for plastic or anything because there's no real regulations on the amount of plastic that can be in compost. So even though compost is tested for a lot of safety measures, plastic is not one of them.
Okay, interesting. But thanks so much. Just, you know, opened my eyes to, you know, what I do in my own backyard. But thank you.
Yes, thanks for having me on today.
All right. That was reporter Claire Caulfield with today's reality check. Head to HonoluluCivilBeat.org to read her story and more.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Kahilu Theater on Hawaii Island, presenting blues and bluegrass band Dirty Cello, performing 7 p.m. Friday, February 21st. Tickets at kahilutheater.org.
Valentine's Day is just around the corner, so what's the best gift for your loved ones? Keeping your heart healthy is a great place to start. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll talk to an expert about the signs and symptoms of heart disease and the best way to treat it. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Dr. David Hiranaka on Hawaii Island, providing facial, cosmetic, and reconstructive surgery and aesthetic services, including laser treatments, online at a-new-face.com.
This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer. They bring us an update on a controversial satellite project that looks to establish a network of high-speed internet across the entire globe.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet, and also things we can try and spot in our dark skies. As usual, turning to the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips, we've got him on the line too. Hey Chris, welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey Dave, good to be back. For this week's Stargazers, the planet Venus will be bright and easily visible throughout the evening until it sets in the west just after 9 p.m. The moon is beginning to wane this week, and so we can expect to return to dark skies by week's end.
And I understand this week you've got an update on a controversial satellite project that we have heard about previously on Stargazer.
Yes, it is, of course, Project Starlink, that ambitious venture by SpaceX to deliver broadband internet to the whole planet. It will achieve this by launching thousands of small satellites into space that will act as a giant communications network. However, Starlink has been the source of a great deal of controversy due to the fact that its satellites are visible from the Earth and have been interfering with astronomical imaging and will potentially disrupt the night sky for everybody on Earth. Now, though, Starlink is facing potential legal action in order to stop its assault on the night sky.
This is such a wild story. So who's putting this together?
Well, this is a group of astronomers, dark sky advocates, and concerned citizens. They're preparing a challenge that will force SpaceX and others to enact a sort of environmental impact statement. This will assess the impact that these mega constellations of satellites will have on our view of the night sky.
And there are already a bunch of these they've shot up there. So would it affect those?
It would not. Right now there's 250 up there at the moment, and they will stay up there until the end of their lifetime.
There's no way to bring them down, huh?
Unfortunately not.
Unbelievable. And I'm guessing since this has such strong global implications, this is an international group of folks coming together about this.
It is, and they're going to take the case to the International Court of Justice, and there they will argue that the night sky is a shared human right under the World Heritage Convention. They will also file a case with the Federal Communications Commission.
Are they going to try to stop the deployment of more of these, or maybe get a modified design that would be less of a hassle?
Yeah, this is a temporary stop on the situation. What they want is for a proper assessment to be conducted into the impact of these mega constellations. The question basically comes down to this: do we want to protect our most sacred shared cultural resource, or do we want a worldwide internet connection?
And these satellites themselves, Chris, they're not that big, right? They're tiny?
They're about the size of a refrigerator.
Compared to most satellites, are they small or are they typical? Is that a typical size?
That's actually very small. Most satellites up there, especially communications ones, are about the size of a school bus.
But they're causing a lot of concern because they really affect people's viewing.
Exactly. The reflective coating on the satellites means that as soon as the sunlight catches them, they can be ablaze in the night sky.
And then all of the conspiracy people are like, look, there's another alien. Look, there's another one.
Right.
Well, we'll be looking for your follow-up on that. Very interesting story. And Christopher Phillips, of course, with that. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week for Stargazer, which is kept at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
For today's Backyard Quiz, we remember Eddie Aikau and the esteemed surfing event held in his honor. In 1984, surf brand Quiksilver held the Eddie at a nearby North Shore beach, but the waves were lackluster and it was a ho-hum affair. After going back to the drawing board, they hit on an idea, a one-day contest at the Aikau ancestral home of Waimea, and only if conditions of 30-foot waves could be sustained all day. It has only been held in those conditions 8 times. 28 surfers plus all alternates are invited, and they stay on standby from December through February. The following winter, Eddie's brother Clyde won the contest, and subsequent years have seen Bruce Irons, Kelly Slater, and John Florence win. Quiksilver sponsored the event until 2016, but the relationship ended after the company could not come to an agreement with the Aikau family. In the winter of 2019, the Eddie, the same event with new, mostly local sponsors and women invitees, awaits for the right waves at Waimea Bay until the end of the month when the holding period ends. But back in 1984, we wondered if anyone who first saw the first Eddie at Sunset Beach knew the big surfing event that it would become almost 40 years later. And congratulations to Aleu from Haula. You got the answer. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, please send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. There's been much ado about the Oscars and the must-see movies. But just around the corner are the GLAAD Awards. This year, two Hawaii filmmakers got word that their documentary is being nominated for the big gala, which will be held in a couple of weeks in New York City. The award acknowledges projects which advance acceptance of the lesbian, gay, bi, and transgender community. Their film, Ladies in Waiting, takes place in Tonga. Dean Hammer and Joe Wilson are the duo behind this creative endeavor. We hear first from Joe.
It's a huge honor. I mean, what GLAAD stands for is the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. So it's been around for a long time, and its purpose has been to ensure, you know, the proper representation of LGBT folks in mainstream media and to help shine light on projects that don't often get recognized in the mainstream world.
And share with our listeners, Dean, what this story is all about.
This story is about Joey Mataele, who is a transgender woman in the Kingdom of Tonga, which is a very small, very religious and conservative island kingdom. And it talks about her struggles growing up, but also about the work that she's been doing to lift up transgender people in the eyes of the society there. And it's about the organization she formed called the Tonga Ladies Association, which provides a home for people. Some of them have been kicked out of their houses, and also has turned into a group that advocates for equality for the transgender people in Tonga.
Now, this is the second film that you folks have done together. The first one was about Hina.
Yeah, the first film we did here as directors in Hawaii was called Kumuhina. It came out in 2014, and it was supported by Pacific Islanders and Communications. Similar story in that it followed a cultural leader here in Hawaii, Hina Le Moana Wong Kalu, as a teacher at the time at a Hawaiian public charter school. Hina actually led us to Tonga because years and years ago, I don't know, it was 20 years ago or so, Hina actually won what was called the Miss Galaxy pageant, which is this big international transgender talent pageant in the Kingdom of Tonga. So when Kumuhina was finished, we were invited actually to take that film to show it in Tonga at the Miss Galaxy pageant, and that's how we met Joey Jolene Mataele.
Wow, that's a nice connect. You know, and I would see you folks out in the community for years following Hina around, you know, at the burial council meetings and just everywhere. And so you spent a lot of time, got some really nice intimate moments with her. And, you know, now you've done this film in Tonga. I mean, how much time did you spend down there?
Well, when we originally went, we just spent a week. We brought our cameras with us, and we started filming the pageant. And we thought, this will just be a short film about this drag pageant. It's pretty hysterical. There are really some funny girls and some funny acts down there. And so when we got back to Hawaii, we started editing that a little bit. And we were going to go back about a year later to finish it up and shoot one more pageant. And that's when Joey told us, well, we're not going to do a pageant this year. We've decided that instead we're going to start advocating for our rights, and we're going to have a big national conversation and a sort of a convention to start a conversation about decriminalizing our lives here in Tonga. And that's when we said, you know, this should be more than just a short film. This is really turning art into activism and something that we should follow. So we then went back three more times altogether. We didn't spend as much time as we do here in Hawaii, but each trip revealed something new. So it was an exciting process.
Can you talk about maybe something that really struck you during your visits down there, Joe, when you were down in Tonga?
Yeah, I think, as Dean said, we were filming during a year when there was a change going on in the discourse in the kingdom about how lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender people should be seen and treated. And what really struck us was that the opposition to more visibility and acceptance for LGBT people in that country was actually coming not from people looking at this from a Tongan cultural perspective, but from evangelical religious agitators who had the backing of a big broadcasting network here in the United States called the Trinity Broadcasting Network. And they were prompting people in Tonga and many other parts of the world to start, you know, using the kind of opposition we see here in the U.S. to more respect and equality, inclusion for people in countries around the world. And I think that made us feel even more so that it was our responsibility as people from the U.S. to help shine light on these divisive forces that are being, you know, kind of promoted and perpetuated from our shores.
One of the really striking things in Tonga is it is still a monarchy, and there's a king and a queen, and they own the country. So it's a serious monarchy. They love the Laitis. Joey herself is of a high-ranked family that has always served the monarchy, and they're very close. She would sit right at the side of the queen and converse with her. And in fact, the sponsor of the Tonga Ladies Association is a high princess. She's the daughter of the queen. So that is the real Tonga, and that is very supportive of gender diversity, and it always has been. It almost felt to us like it was outside missionaries from the U.S. and from New Zealand and Australia coming in who were spreading and these new ideas about gay is bad and sort of stirring things up a lot.
And so this film, where did it make its debut?
So we were lucky that the film premiered actually at the British Museum in London. It was quite an exciting opportunity because there was a delegation of Tongan officials there. And since that launch, it has really traveled around the world, from Tahiti to all across the U.S., throughout Europe. We actually did a tour in China with the film. And, of course, Joey and other members of the Tonga Ladies Association have been traveling with this film around the Pacific because it's become an important way to bring people together in communities on small islands throughout the Pacific to, you know, talk about these issues, see people's lives that they can really identify with, and strategize together about how do they have these conversations in their communities and countries to help create change.
And to fund a film like this, I mean, is it hard to get the support behind an endeavor like this?
Well, when you talk about a film about transgender activism in the Kingdom of Tonga, it's not an easy sell. If we were in Hollywood, I don't think we'd get very far. But we're really fortunate that here in Hawaii, we have an organization, Pacific Islanders in Communications, which collaborates with PBS to support stories like this and to get them out for public broadcast. And so we were very fortunate to be supported by them, and that made it possible for us to travel to Tonga and to edit the film and to work with Kumuhina, who's a co-producer on the film, to put it all together.
Now, I haven't seen it, but has it had a broadcast date on PBS already?
Yes, it was broadcast on PBS this May, and it continues to be broadcast on PBS Hawaii probably twice a year, so we're very happy about that. It was also broadcast in New Zealand and Australia, where there are so many Pacific Islander communities, in Europe on Arte, and it's really getting around the world.
If I can just give another shout-out to why, like, PIC funding is so important, I think you may have noticed the Oscar nominations were announced. And immediately after, because of all the challenges that the Academy Awards has had with, you know, bringing forward diverse voices, the hashtags that became popular on social media initially were Oscars so white, Oscars so male, and Oscars so straight, because once again, there really aren't, there's no women directors that were nominated. LGBT representation is nil in this year's Academy Awards. So the GLAAD Media Awards have kind of become known informally as the LGBT Oscars. And I think what's significant about PIC is one of the organizations that gets diverse voices onto the national media landscape through its Pacific Heartbeat series, which goes out, I think, to like 80% of public television stations across the U.S.
Was there anything that you were struck by in your visits down to Tonga, Dean?
I think for me the biggest surprise was how close the Leyte community is to the religious community, because here we're accustomed to trans people and gay people sort of being enemies of religion because they've been so bad to us. And there, religion is just, it's like oxygen. Like, you can't live without it. Everybody is religious. And all of the Leytes were highly religious and would go to services when they could. And so it was really interesting to see that integration and getting along together. You know, we often say Hawaii is a small place. Tonga is a lot smaller than that, and you can really see it in the way people get along. And it was wonderful that some of the religious people, including the bishop or the head of the Catholic Church there, was one of the greatest supporters of the ladies. Quite a change from what we're used to here.
And, you know, there is talk about, oh, you know, sometimes to get an authentic voice, it needs to be by and about. But you folks aren't from Tonga, you know, or Hawaii. I don't know what your backgrounds are, but, you know, you are still able to capture kind of the truth, I guess, behind, you know, this reality.
Yeah, well, projects like this are really collaborations. You know, it's not about one person or a set of people who are kind of determining and controlling everything. And So following the Kumuhina project, Hina moved from in front of the camera to behind and became actually a producer on this project and a cultural advisor because she speaks Tongan. She has much experience in the kingdom on many different fronts. And then Joey, as we were traveling with Jolene with the film and festivals and other places, she would often tell the story that when she knew that we were going to be bringing the Kumuhina film down to screen in Tonga, she had in the back of her mind a plan to hatch that would address the dream that she had always had, that they would be able to tell their stories to a broader audience. So we're flying down to show our film, and she's thinking, when these guys get here, I'm going to ask them if they'll make a film about us.
She was hatching a plan.
Yeah. So it really became a collaboration, you know, and she is an amazing force in Tonga. As Dean said, you know, she's well-known and respected by the royal family and many other people across the country. So it was she who opened doors and opportunities for the cameras to capture what they captured. It really was that kind of collaboration.
I think we found that throughout our work. We are, of course, two white gay guys coming in. We're clearly not from Tonga or from Samoa or from Hawaii. But people have been so interested in telling their stories and getting it out that we've felt like it's been a very natural and a very organic type of collaboration. And I think people have learned from the history of our films that we're not out to exploit them, but rather to lift them up and to lift their own stories up. And this has continued when we were showing Ladies in Waiting and traveling around the Pacific with Joey. We were fortunate to be invited to Samoa, and there we learned about a group of transgender men. So these are young people who were born as females but feel inside that they are male, and they formed a wonderful group called the Rogers. And they're doing their own thing, and we're just coming out with a new film about that group, also supported by Pacific Islanders and Communication, that will come out soon.
Okay, well, I can't wait.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. The Rogers are known as the first visible group of transgender men in the Pacific, called the Fa'atama.
All right, and when do you think we're going to see the debut?
Very soon.
Very soon. This spring. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us, Catherine.
Thank you, Catherine, yeah.
You've been hearing from Dean Hammer and Joe Wilson, nominated for a GLAAD Award for their film Ladies in Waiting that was funded by the Pacific Islanders in Communications.
America, are we ready? The next test for Democrats and for the election process is the New Hampshire primary. I'm Brian Lehrer from WNYC. We've teamed up with Laura Kanoy and New Hampshire Public Radio for a national call-in special on primary night. Iowa failed to shine in its moment in the spotlight. How will New Hampshire do with its first-in-the-nation primary? The time to listen and to participate is now. America, are we ready?
Tuesday afternoon at 2.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we hear more about the coronavirus and preparedness from the Hawaii Healthcare Association. Got a question or comment? Please call our talkback line. Leave your comments. That number, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation, HPR, or tweet us at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of the show, want to find a past one, find them all on The Conversation page. Look under HPR News and Talk on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.